on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting again with 93-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California, a recipient of the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart while serving with the 101st Airborne 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment during World War II. When we left off, he had jumped into the Netherlands as part of the ill-fated Operation Market Garden in the fall of 1944. If you've read the book A Bridge Too Far or seen the movie of the same name, you know about Operation Market Garden. Let's get back to how Tom experienced it 70 years ago.
We went into Erde, Scheindel. We went up to a place called Coffin Corner, up where the dike meets the bridge that goes into Arnhem. It was occupied by the Scottish Black Watch Regiment. They were a real good regiment, and they had their equipment in there. And the night of October 4th, we went into Driel and replaced them. They marched out of there with their bagpipes going and their national anthem. That was a tough place. We were in a tough spot there. We were surrounded again. So we figured, since we're surrounded again, it sounds like the same old story. So what are we going to do? Attack. So there's battles up and down the dike all the time. We threw hand grenades over the dike, hoping that they would get caught and go into the trenches where the Germans were. Some didn't. Some rolled all the way down. So then we tied nylon string on them and threw them over, pulled them up a little bit where we thought, and the Germans were throwing hand grenades at us. It was a crazy battle.
Yeah, well, and you can laugh about it now, but I'm sure it was no laughing matter at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And how close was enemy artillery, enemy bullets, enemy hand grenades? How close were they coming to you?
Not too close, because I was back a little bit with the mortar. I was back maybe 50 yards, but I knew it was happening. There was a gap in the dike. They ran a German tank back and forth there every night, making all the noise you could possibly, squeaking, and you know how tank tracks would go. Mm-hmm. All the noise possible, trying to just keep us awake and uneasy. Then that tank tried to break through that gap. One of the guys ran over to a British 6-pound artillery piece, threw a shell in it, and started hitting every lever he could. It fired. It set part of the ammunition up toward the bridge, and it hit a little guardhouse. It was about 2x2, whether it was a guy in there or not, no. And he saw that, and then he lowered the thing, and he put another one in it, and he fired that thing, and it hit the tank. He stopped the tank from coming through. In the meantime, a guy was running along the side of the dike. He put a bazooka shell into the tank. So the argument now is, who did it? Who stopped the tank?
Who gets the credit?
Who gets the Silver Star?
Yeah.
That's what it was.
That's what it came down to.
Yeah, huh? The guy that shot the guy on our side, named Frank Carpenter, he got the Silver Star for shooting that 6-pounder at the tank. They couldn't prove this one guy was all by himself. We all the rest of us saw that.
What do you think would have happened if the tank wasn't stopped?
It'd have gotten inside of our perimeter. We'd have stopped it.
It would have cost you some lives.
It might have cost us, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were there at the called the island for 3 months under the British Second Army under General Montgomery. Hated the guy.
Why?
We weren't supposed to be there. He just refused to release us.
Mm-hmm. And it was day after day of battle?
Yeah. Rain. There was a Polish group of battalion of Polish jumpers jumped in there, and they gave him the worst possible objectives. And General Wiebrowski, he knew it. He hated Montgomery and told us so. So there was a lot of animosity there. Gave him the worst jump possible. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the Polish were killed, you know, which was maybe 4 days after Market Garden had already developed.
Right. So, as day after day of this goes by, do you get more used to it? Do you start to get numb to the sights and the sounds and the smells and the fact that you're probably losing buddies? How did you handle that?
Ran patrols from the dike out maybe a mile or 3/4 mile out into the flooded area to a brick factory. We had a couple of guys there in a brick factory in the chimney watching the Germans across. Mm-hmm. We ran patrols out, but the Germans had filtered into that flatland too, so we were running into them. Not many of them, but a few. We were also observed from the railroad track, which was about 60 feet above us on a very steep slope, because we were in a big barn, and we had British 10-in-1 rations, and we hated all the peas and carrots, so we lined the rafters with cans of peas and carrots and ate all the rest of it. We were back and forth near. The Germans observed my mortar position. They threw in some mortar rounds on it, and they didn't knock out the gun, but they destroyed my ammunition.
So where were you?
I don't know at that moment where I was.
Good thing you weren't there.
Yeah, it's a good thing I wasn't there. I took a bazooka and got back from the dike a little bit. There was a 3-story house right next to the dike on the German side with windows from floor to ceiling. I put a bazooka round into the right through the window and exploded inside. So the guys were all laughing about that. I didn't get permission to do it.
But you knew it was German occupied.
Yeah, I knew it was occupied because they could see us.
Right.
I tied a rope on the gunny sack bag that I had with the ammunition that had been pelted and pulled it to see if it was going to explode, because it was too dangerous to go in there and start handling, and it didn't. It was all right. So after Market Garden and 3 months there, we were sent to France, Reims, Marmelon, France. We had a furlough a few days before that. Instead of going to Venice and Marseille, I chose Paris. I climbed the northwest leg of the Eiffel Tower up to the first level. And the first level was a restaurant. You couldn't go any higher because it was barbed wire.
Mm-hmm. And, you probably weren't supposed to climb that, were you?
No, weren't supposed to do that.
What possessed you?
Yeah, it was big. It was there. There was gendarmes around, but be careful of the gendarmes because their capes, the edge of their capes were lined with lead. They swing a cape at you and that'll knock you down. You never expect that. Uh-huh. They had billy clubs. Your focus would be on that billy club, but not the cape.
But you must have been quick enough to get up before they could catch you, huh?
I got up to this first level and then came down, and that was enough. We just had to do it.
So you get your R&R in Paris, and you have no idea that there's going to be something called the Battle of the Bulge, and you're going to be freezing your butt off at Bastogne before long, huh?
Yeah. They called us out of Paris and Reims while we were there resting. Our weapons were turned in that were damaged. Our clothing was dirty, stinking stuff. We had to wait for new clothing, clean clothing. So, see, we were fairly well depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And when the order came in to board those 40-8s, there's some things we didn't have. I had my submachine gun, but little, if any, ammunition. I didn't have a jacket. I had no gloves. I might have had a K ration or two in my pocket. That's about it.
So you had no idea what you were getting into.
No, I didn't know where we're going. Mm-hmm. I didn't know where we're going. We were going like a bat out of hell to get there, trucks, and with the lights way down, you know. And we got into Bastogne, and we got out of the trucks, and I saw on the streets, the main street, tanks after tank after tank, right up against the commercial buildings and the stores. All the guns pointing toward Germany, out of gas. The 106th Infantry Division guys were coming through, dragging their rifles, saying, "They're coming. You be careful. Watch out. There's hordes of them." We took their guns and ammunition. We were headed toward Neffy and southeast. We were on the wrong track. Colonel Canard got us on the wrong road, got that corrected. We headed out toward Neffy. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with that, all that territory, but on a hill there is called Martizan. There is a museum, and we settled in that area. We were not supposed to go in an attack. We were told to set up a defense. On the way down that long slope, cordoned off with barbed wire, they saw us. They put in some artillery shells and mortars. The platoon sergeant got killed. We set up a defense line, no food now. This is December 19th, 22nd. I got some food, a big pancake made of potatoes, mashed potatoes, slapped in my hands. A guy came by, said, "Open your hand." He wham, put that in and thanked him. He said, "Wait." He put in some hot potatoes on top of that. So I just kept, I didn't eat them yet. I just kept to warm my hands and then saved some of it, put it in my pocket and say, "We don't care, there's no germs on this. We're too tough for that, you know." Just save some of it. The order came down to patrol out in front. There was two villages out there, Neff, N-E-F-F-E, and Margaret. They wanted me to patrol those. They sent me out on a patrol, and I think it was about six guys. We went down the long slope that we came to a fork in the road. Across this fork was a haystack. It was hard, brittle, had been there for years probably. So we came into that. The patrol zigzagged back and forth, slowed down and was able to speed up because of the barbed wire fence. You had to go across those. Well, they were watching us. Ground was covered with snow, and we were in khaki. I got to the fork of the road. Now, which one am I going to take? I had decided on this one. Over in this area, deep valleys and very high hills. Wouldn't call them mountains, but high hills. We're going to take this way to Neffy.
Away from the hills.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I sent scout number one out, and scout number two was at the fork. I was back there. I sent number two 50 yards from scout number one, and I was at the fork. And I noticed up in front of me, machine gun bullets were hitting in the ditch we were in. I knew what was going to happen. Waiting for the rest of that patrol to come down, get in that ditch, move up the ditch, then they're going to fire on the backside of the patrol because they know we're going to back out of there in a hurry. So I saw all the machine gun hitting up there. I told number two scout to call number one scout back. And when I did, I stood up. I knew the risk I was taking. They saw me, and I got a shot in the left leg just above the knee.
As soon as you stood up, they hit you?
Yeah, they hit me. They knew I was. They knew the number three man was going to be the leader.
Mm-hmm.
See? So number one is out there. We got him to come around and go this way. I got him in this direction before I was hit. Number two scout, I called it back to me. I said, give me a shot of morphine. I carried 18 syrettes of it in case of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He just uncorked one and shot me in the arm with it, and I never felt pain at all from there.
How bad was your wound?
I had to test it to find out if it was broken bone. So I stood up again to test it and take a turn, sent number two over here, and as I turned, my arm came up like this. Got one through the arm.
You're standing up because you realize you might be taking your patrol into an ambush.
Yeah.
You needed to reroute them, or else all you guys might
die. I told those guys, I'm going to get you in this. I'm going to get you out of this.
And you might have all died had you not done that. So you put yourself at risk. You get hit in the leg. Then you're trying to figure out if your left femur is broken or not. So you stand up again and they hit you in the arm.
Hit me in the arm because I turned this way.
Right.
I turned this way, and it got me running right through the arm, dropped my machine gun, my helmet came off, and I spun a little bit, and the next one went right by my ear. I could hear it pop. That leg wasn't broken. I could feel the warmth of blood in my boots. I hit that haystack and bounced off of it because it was so brittle and frozen. Yeah. And I was there for hours. I told second scout, take him back, it's over. And so here I am out here, maybe a mile out into, what do we call it, no man's land, if you want to use that term, looking around waiting. The thing that scared me the most was they're going to set that haystack on fire.
You're by yourself, wounded in two different places.
Yeah.
Bleeding, but you didn't feel pain because of the morphine.
No pain.
Did you think you were going to die right there?
No. I'm wondering if they're going to send a squad out, and how quickly are they going to come out there after me? Mm-hmm. They didn't know that I was wounded.
The Germans didn't know.
They really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But their objective was to break up that patrol.
Uh-huh.
And they did. The patrol was a disaster. So here I am looking up and down the road. How am I going to get back? I'm going to roll across the road and go the other direction. Meantime, a guy by the name of John W. Curtis, he was on the patrol. He volunteered to come out from another direction along the road up the ditch that was frozen over. And I saw him. So I rolled across the road and went into the ditch. I said, John, give me the butt of your rifle. So I took that with the left hand. He pushed and pulled with his feet. I pushed and pulled with my feet. And we went a half a mile up the ditch. Then he helped me get up to where the defense line was. There was a Jeep there. They put me on the Jeep and took me into Bastogne, into the nunnery. There was four Belgique Catholic nuns there. They were taking care of us. Now, I'm under a real state of shock. The floor was covered with guys occupying stretchers, all wounded. So we were there until Patton broke through.
Was it all the nuns helping you? Were there American medical personnel there, too?
When I came in, they put me on an operating table, great big makeshift thing. I said, Colonel, I'm hungry. He said, get that man a sandwich. I got a jam and peanut butter sandwich eating while they ran a swab about that long with a big cotton ball in it right through the arm. That cleared all the broken bone.
In your right arm.
In the right arm. And they ran that swab through there, and that kind of cleared it up, and they just maneuvered it around.
So while they're doing that, sticking this big swab through your broken arm and bloody arm, you're eating a sandwich.
Eating a sandwich.
Hey.
Then they put me on the stretcher, and then Patton broke through. Then they took me to the 121st Field Hospital. There was a nurse there.
Yeah.
This nurse was 6'1". She weighed 160 pounds.
Uh-huh.
She was a strong gal. So when I wanted to go to the bathroom, she sent a prisoner down to take me to the bathroom and back. When we got relief out of the 121st Hospital to go to Paris, she put a great big red ribbon on my neck like that, a big bow.
Yeah.
For some reason, she liked me.
I guess so.
Her name was Lieutenant Janice Van Hees. How pretty, I don't know. It's wartime. Every one of them is a beauty. So here I am. I'm taken to the American embassy in Paris. They couldn't keep me down. Stitches broke, got infected. I'm walking around. They decided I better go be sent to England. So with the red bow on it, I was put on a lighter in a baby crib, and the English seaman called me Little Lord Fauntleroy, teasing me. So here I am. I went to the American hospital in England. There was another guy in there by the name of Rice. Now I'm going to go for operation. I went for three operations there. They fed me and starved him. I was supposed to go for operation, but they fed me, and I counted to 104 under sodium pentothal, and that's dangerous, because if I'd have thrown up, there's nothing they could have done.
Yeah.
I got through that one all right, but the nurse said, don't ever tell anybody what happened.
I didn't. So, of all the close calls, that may have been your closest, and it wasn't even the Germans that did it to you.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And he never shies away from those dangerous situations, not even at 93. When we come back, the rest of Tom's story, including what the self-described risk-taker does every year on June 6th. You won't find most 93-year-olds trying this. Photos of it at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.